Today, we are looking at the future of the Russian economy. How is it that in a country so rich in oil, locals are waiting in line for hours just to get a little bit of gasoline in their car? Hey, and welcome to The Dip. I'm Cassandra, and our podcast today is really going to be adding some spice to the world's most important economic stories. But first, like I said, I want to know what the heck happened, but I want to start with a little bit of context. So this is all a consequence of Ukrainian attacks on Russian fossil fuel infrastructure. We're talking wave after wave of drone strikes on equipment that's really important for turning crude oil into the gasoline that people pump into their cars, right? And it's even gotten so bad that the usually, let's say, optimistic President Vladimir Putin is admitting that there is a problem. And that's because people are feeling that problem. Because even by the time they get to the front of these lines to put some gasoline in their cars, they're paying what are 20-year highs for the privilege. So has Russia's war on Ukraine finally come home? To get into this, I'm joined by two fabulous guests. Up first, we have Yanis Kluge. He's one of Europe's leading researchers analyzing Russia's economy, the effects of sanctions, and finances. Thanks for being here, Yanis. And also on the line, we have Sergei Alexashenko, who's previously worked not only for the Russian Finance Ministry, but for the Russian Central Bank. But now, that must seem like a previous life, now he is on Putin's most wanted list. So Sergei, thanks for joining us. I want to start with you. What have you done to land on Putin's most wanted list?
Cassandra, nice to be with you. Yanis, very nice to see you once again. Cassandra, the answer to your question is very simple. After Russian invasion of Ukraine, a group of Russians, political and public figures in exile, established a group that is called the Russian Anti-War Committee. And we protested against the war. We tried to enforce European and American politicians to make proper decisions. We support Russians who left the country. We support Ukraine. And the last year, the Federal Security Service, former KGB, announced us in attempting to seize of power in Russia. And it is the most heavy criminal case with 25 plus years in prison. So you can imagine that there is no more bigger danger to Mr. Putin than to lose the power.
And I wanted to stay with you for an extra moment here, Sergei. What are you hearing or observing in Russia about these long gasoline waits right now? How big of a deal is this?
The deal is very big in public opinion. And you were right completely in the introduction saying that all of this is the result of the war against Ukraine, Russian invasion, and the strikes of Ukrainian drones and missiles. But above that, we have to add that Russian economy is mostly in oil sector, is strongly monopolized, controlled by five big companies, three of them belong to the state and controlled by the state. And Russian retail gasoline market is regulated by the government, which, according to Putin's desire, wants to prices to be stable. So to grow slowly, independently of what's going in the market. And yes, the production of gasoline in Russia declined by different estimates from 15 to 20%. But the biggest concern, the biggest problem of the market is that distribution doesn't work. The market doesn't exist because it's controlled by big companies, independent companies. They have no own refineries. And the problem is in distribution. So regions that have a shortage of gasoline, companies are operating there. They cannot purchase gasoline from other regions because prices are regulated, markets are monopolized. So combined together, that's created shortages in different regions. In Russia, we have 85 regions. And as of today, 21 of them announced on regional level by regional governors or governments, they introduced limitations, regulations, control, and so on. And Crimea is fully banned for private citizens to purchase gasoline. So we may say that every fourth region of Russia is suffering from this crisis. And many other cases, even in Moscow, where market is not closed, and statistical agency reports that the price growth in price is very, very slow. Still, people can sometimes stay in lines for an hour, 2 hours or more.
That's like just a whole nother level when you say that private citizens are actually banned from purchasing gasoline. But Yanis, I want to bring you in on this because you told me offline in our chats earlier this week that this gas crisis is the most urgent topic for Russian authorities. Break this down. Why is this so important?
First of all, great to be with you, and also, Sergey, great to see you again. I think it's the most important issue at the moment because the Russian government or the Kremlin has the goal to at least partially insulate average Russians from the impact of this war. This has worked at periods, you know, times quite well. At other times, it hasn't worked. Previously, we had a mobilization, which, of course, affected lots of people who didn't want to be affected by it in Russia. But we overall had a stable or even good economic situation for most. And now we have impacts of the war, not just that the drone strikes are visible, but also that average Russians are struggling to find gasoline. And it's, this is something that you feel directly in your lives. In a way, it is even more severe than just general inflation, because it's a specific good that you cannot, keep on carrying on your daily routine without, and, that actually creates real problems. So I think it's a bit embarrassing. It's not clear yet how severe this is going to be in the next days and weeks. We will find out more about that. But as it stands, I would say it is, it looks pretty bad for the Kremlin.
One thing that I keep hearing from colleagues and analysts is that this is giving kind of the end of the USSR vibes, right? We're hearing lots of comparisons to these kinds of shortages, empty fridges versus empty gas tanks. And I'm wondering, Sergey, I believe you were in the USSR at that time. What's your view? Is this comparison fair?
Cassandra, I may disclose a secret. I had a chance to work in the government of the USSR, being a very junior special in 1991, and my mail address was Moscow Kremlin Alexashenko. So it's funny. But being serious, of course, there is nothing similar to the Soviet Union in economic system. The biggest difference is how the economy is finding the re-establishing equilibrium. In economic development, in any economy, equilibrium is the most important. And if economy is disequilibrated, that's a crisis. In market economies, it's very simple. It's prices. So as soon as you have some disturbances, markets in one sector grow faster, in others grow slower, you have bankruptcies or booming growth in other sectors, and finally, economy reestablishes its balance. In the Soviet Union, everything was decided by bureaucrats. One bureaucrat decided in a state planning committee, Gosplan, they decided which company will produce what and where. Second agency, Gosnap, distribution agency, they decided who will supply raw materials to this company and where this company will sell its goods. Next agency decided what is the price. So next agency decided how much labor you need. Mm. Another agency decided what should be the salary. Another agency decided what should be price, and so on and so far. And you see, and when economy was developing smoothly, okay, bureaucrats had enough time to agree with themselves, to change something, to adjust, and to keep economy equilibrated. But as the situation started to develop much faster in the second half of 80s, they had no time. Moreover, the biggest problem in the second half of 80s was the lack of political understanding what to do and political will to do something to change the system. Of course, today Russia, despite all problems, despite monopolization, Putin's control, national control of the economy, state participation, still it is a market economy where the bulk of prices are free, and that's why market can be equilibrated. That is, as I said, one of the reasons of these gasoline prices. This market is regulated, prices are regulated, and market is monopolized. That's why we see all those effects that are similar to the Soviet economy. But all the rest is very different.
Yeah, no, a totally fair observation. I think when I'm hearing these videos or seeing these videos, it's more of vibes-based. But I want to go back to these long queues at gas stations. Yanis, Russia's still a major oil exporter, despite having such long lines and outages and straight-up bans, like Sergey was mentioning. How does this all make sense?
Well, it's just different goods, different products. Russia exports crude oil. It also exports oil products, especially diesel. But, you know, you could even make the connection. If Russia cannot refine its own crude oil anymore, then it has to export it. So we saw even in recent weeks that Russian crude exports were increasing and not decreasing, which is a sign of Russian refineries not being able to take in the same amount of crude oil. So it's a different market, a different product. Russia exports a lot of diesel. With gasoline, usually it consumes about as much as it produces. That's why I think that, Sergey already pointed out with regards to diesel, it's definitely a logistics problem. There should be enough diesel available in the country, just not where it is needed. With regards to gasoline, Russia probably actually has to import it because it doesn't have the same amount of spare capacity. One quick remark, I found the discussion really interesting about, you know, what about this current situation is maybe so a Soviet experience. And, as Sergey mentioned, the prices are controlled. So now we have scarcity of gasoline and it's not regulated by the market, but it is regulated also by regional governments who tell people how much gasoline they allow to get gas for, and it's regulated. And the price is also the time that you spend in the queue, of course. You know, if you're willing to queue for a few hours, then you will get it. If not, then not. So it's a business. Maybe those kind of distribution systems were also more common in the Soviet Union. And so it's basically, if Russian gasoline prices were free, then we would probably see higher prices, but maybe not this scarcity and limitations in volume. So that, but they're not. So they're not rising as quickly as gas prices in the West would rise.
Okay. I can't help but wonder, taking all this into consideration, if the Russian war on Ukraine, that maybe it's no longer just on a screen for your average Russian, but that the war is actually coming home. Sergey, what's your view?
I would say that the biggest task, biggest idea of Kremlin, is, as Yanis rightly mentioned, is to keep Russian public opinion, Russian minds, Russians outside of the war. So they should not think about war, they should not use the word war, and they should live ordinary life. And as the war continues the fifth year, of course, the effects of the war are more and more visible. More and more people are drafted by the army. More and more people receive their members of the family killed or wounded in actions. And that's widespread. And we see the internal tension within the society. So the polls show that the bigger and bigger share of Russians believe that it's time to end the war. And even top rank officials and managers of state-controlled companies, like, for example, German Greff, who is the CEO of Sberbank, the biggest Russian bank, or Alexander Novak, who is a deputy prime minister in charge of the industry, they said, okay, it's time to end the war. It's the biggest problem, it's the biggest break, and it doesn't help our economy. So that discontent inside the society is growing. But being in an authoritarian regime, we should not wait that it will be a political discontent, political revolt, or something like that. Because Putin and his clique, they control the power structures, and of course they can depress all revolts.
I want to just zoom in on that for just a quick second, because I can't help but wonder, is your average Russian connecting the dots between gasoline shortages and the war, or are these viewed by most people as a separate issue, Sergey?
50-50. And even those who connect this shortage of gasoline with the war, they do not connect it with Russian aggression against Ukraine. They connect it with Ukrainian strikes. Why do they strike us? We should defeat them. We should destroy them. Yeah, the consequences of steps or dots is different. It's not Russia which invaded Ukraine and Ukraine is defending itself. it's Ukraine who is attacking Russia, and Russia is a peaceful country. We do nothing.
Giannis, the Russian government is spending a lot of money propping up the military and its war in Ukraine. How long in this kind of war, and with the costs that we're talking about here, how long is this sustainable?
I think it is sustainable. It's just a question of if the government manages to put the costs on the population. The economy doesn't really mind if a lot is produced for the war, and it can continue to function. There is not a real limit to that. It's just a problem of the distribution of resources in the country. Who gets what the country produces? And now more is needed for the war. And the question is, how will the Kremlin manage to steer more resources into the war? And the way this materializes is, for example, in the state budget, where you have a growing hole. And to fill that hole, the government, I mean, they already increased taxes several times. They might have to do that again. They might have to cut spending in some other places. We saw that the Iran war did not help that much for the Russian budget. And so cutting expenditures is back on the agenda. And this is a painful process, even in an authoritarian state like Russia's. It's not always simple to just take away money from some parts of the population, but that's what it's going to take. So I don't see a real limit. I just think that it's a challenge, and that it might change also the face of the Russian regime at some point, when it will impose harsher costs on the population going forward.
Giannis, prior to the war, Russia, like many large fossil fuel exporting nations, had a pretty large sovereign wealth fund, which is, I kind of think of it like a bit of a rainy day fund. And so I'm wondering, 4 years into this war, has this rainy day fund or any other buffer, does it still exist in the Russian economy? Like, how much of a safety net is there still for the Russian government here?
The National Wealth Fund in Russia wasn't that big before the full-scale invasion. So, there was already some of it withdrawn because of COVID, was used to cover deficits. It was used to cover deficits also in the years 2022 to 2024. Last year, it was not used at all because the liquid part of it is just about 2% of GDP. So it's not really... it doesn't make a huge difference. And the Russian government at the moment is simply borrowing domestically. So this National Wealth Fund, it doesn't play a role at the moment for financing. So it's not a cushion anymore. It's more like sort of, maybe you could say, Putin's personal purse. They can invest funds from that fund into companies, into projects that they find politically important, and maybe sometimes get around the budget that way. So that's another function it fulfills. But there's basically no buffer there anymore. All that is there in deficits has to be raised now from new debt.
Watching this war from my perch in Berlin for the last 4.5 years, it has seemed like, from my vantage point, that maybe sanctions weren't living up to their potential, that they weren't these big punches on the Russian economy. But now you have these relentless drone attacks by Ukraine, and that seems to be doing the job. Am I wrong here, Sergey? Or is this more of just a recipe of, sanctions, economic warfare, so to speak, physical warfare plus time equals the state that we're at now?
Yes and no, Cassandra. Of course, sanctions did their harm. They affected Russian economy. But as I said previously, Russian economy is a market economy. And to overpass the consequences of sanctions and the sanctions pressure, it's not the job of the government. It's the job of Russian private business, which has a very simple choice, to die or to survive. Live free or die, like I always say in New Hampshire. And that's the issue, yeah? For any business, sanctions is an obstacle, is a problem you have to solve. And solving the problem in business making means to spend a little bit more money, a little bit more efforts, to use other logistics, to rebuild your schemes, and so on and so far. And Russia, being the producer of commodities, being in the very beginning of the industrial chain, Russia can survive because the global economy cannot live without Russian resources. Russia keeps one of top five places in producing of 20 different types of commodities, not only crude and refined products, but aluminium, gold, nickel, palladium, copper, and so on, the fertilizer, and so on, so far. So that's that helps Russian economy to survive, and that's why Russian economy is adjusted to sanctions. Yeah, and yes, sanctions harm. The overall price of the sanctions as additional transactional cost varies between 1 and 1.5% of GDP. That is deducted from the growth, but that doesn't mean the Russian economy can grow. Ukrainian strikes is different. They destroy physical infrastructure. They destroy physical equipment, which it is which requires a long time to rebuild, and sometimes a long time to acquire equipment, because many of Russian refineries they were renovated in 2010s using European or American equipment, and of course it's not something smaller that you can bring in your suitcase traveling by the plane. It requires sophisticated schemes to be ordered and transported via third or fourth country. So it may take months to rebuild this refinery. So that is the difference. That is the difference. Ukrainian strikes, they destroy physical, industrial, and logistical infrastructure. And it is very difficult and long time consuming to avoid this.
We've spoken here a lot about sanctions in this conversation, but one country that's still doing a lot of business with Russia is China. I've been looking at some of these figures, though, and it seems like that relationship is growing stronger and stronger, Yannis. At some point, could Russia tip into a dependency with China?
Oh, Russia is already in a dependency. The question is more what the political consequences of that are. At the moment, I don't think it's a problem for the Kremlin. So Russia could not continue this war without the technology it gets through China. China is not only a supplier of Chinese technologies, but also the main supplier of Western technologies to Russia. So a lot of sanctions circumvention goes through China. It's also important for the Russian reserve system, financial system. So it plays many roles. And so I see a clear dependency. I think that it's not a huge problem for Putin at the moment, because his goals and the goals of Beijing are to some degree aligned. So Beijing doesn't want Russia to lose this war. It doesn't want Putin to fall. It doesn't want political instability in Russia, and those are also Putin's goals. And so China will not do anything that, you know, weakens Russia or weakens the regime at this point. In that sense, this dependency, from my point of view, at least at this time, is not a problem. It could turn into a problem maybe later down the road. But yeah, I think at the moment it's a price that is accepted by the Russian government, and there is also no other choice.
What I'm hearing over this conversation, and you've both been so generous with your time, but as we start to wrap up, what I've been hearing is that there is not, just to be clear, an impending collapse of the Russian economy coming anytime soon. But it seems like stagnation is definitely the name of the game at this moment. But looking forward, Sergey, what are the options for Mr. Putin to get this economy out of the doldrums?
There is only one option: to end the war. And I think he has to look on the U.S. President Donald Trump, on his experience and his political talent to cut losses. So after the invasion of Ukraine Iran, President Trump recognized that he has a choice: either to full scale land in the invasion or to some type of peace agreement, peace talks. And do not continue, despite he was not able to reach his political goals. So it is business approach. Cut your losses. Putin doesn't want to do it. Putin wants to increase his bets. And that means all bets should be paid by Russian economy and by Russian households. And in fact, if he wants Russian economy to revitalize, to regenerate growth, he needs to end the war. If he wants to continue the war, there is no option for the economy, one or another.
Yannis, in your view, how long can Russia keep going on like this?
it can go, you know, it can keep going on like this for a long time, but the price is going to increase. And so if you say it's going to continue in a way where most Russians are not really affected by the war, I think that we are already reaching the limits of that. The war has become too big and too expensive for that to, and also Ukraine has simply developed too much militarily to for the Kremlin to really shield its population effectively from, at least in the European part of Russia, from this war. So that period probably is ending this year, and it will be more of a factor in the everyday life of Russians. But economically, again, I don't see a limit. I also am, you know, even looking at the budget problems and deficits, you can make some calculations how long it will take for this to become sort of a vicious cycle with debt. And it is still a few years of high deficits until that's the case. So at least, you know, there is no strict limit in number, you know, terms of months or years, you know, how long this war can continue from a strictly economic perspective.
Sergey, last one to you in the Granite State of New Hampshire. Do you agree, or maybe not to ask you to peer into your crystal ball, how long can this war go on?
I fully agree with Yanis. I can second every his word. And that was my approach since the beginning of the war. Economy is not a limit for Putin's war. War does not is not anything else except of political desire, political maniacal desire to destroy the neighboring country. And Putin is ready to pay any price, at least at the moment. We have to recognize that the price of the war is limited for Russia. And maybe it's not a coincidence that he calls it a special military operation. Before the war, Russian military expenditures were 3% of GDP, plus or minus several decimal points. Today, it's about 7 to 7.5 percentage point of GDP. So the increase is not significant. It's not 50%, 15% of GDP that was spent by the Soviet Union. And of course, it's not 40 or 50% that was spent during the Second World War. So he can survive. He can continue, unfortunately. And I share this opinion with Yanis.
Sergey, Yanis, thank you both so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you, Cassandra. Yanis, bye.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
That is it for us this week on The Dip. Now, you've probably noticed that both Kai and Daniel are missing this week. They are actually off trading Pokemon cards somewhere, but they'll be back with you and with me, more importantly, very soon. And if you have any questions or comments, you can, of course, always leave them wherever you're watching or listening to this podcast right now. But if you need a little more space, if you have something on your mind or you have like a proper rant, go ahead and shoot us an email at thedip@dw.com. We love getting your messages there as well. But of course, until next time, thank you so much for watching The Dip. The dip, the dip, the dip.